Today, we're going to extend the household production model by looking at labor to supply decisions within a household framework where there's more than one individual making decisions over the allocation of time, and also how individuals will change their labor supply decisions over time in response to changing market circumstances. In terms of choosing how much time to spend in various activities, the basic principle that economists tend to use is the principle of comparative advantage. The argument here is very similar to the argument you learned in your micro principles class, that in an economy, the total amount of output is maximized if each individual specializes in those activities in which they possess a comparative advantage. Same argument occurs across nations, that total output in the global economy is maximized if each nation specializes in those tasks in which they have a comparative advantage and trade for those commodities in which they do not possess a comparative advantage. The definition, again, of comparative advantage, one that you've probably seen several times in other classes, is that an individual or a country possesses a comparative advantage in an activity if the opportunity cost of that activity is lower for the individual or country than for any other individual or country. So within the household framework, an individual has a comparative advantage in doing something if the opportunity cost of that task is lower for them than it would be for other individuals in a household. For most of this discussion, we'll assume that there's a two-person household. There's going to be a husband and wife in a typical household, and we'll look at the allocation of time between them. The basic principle here, though, is that we'd expect individuals to specialize in those tasks in which it's lower, the opportunity cost in them doing it is lower than for the other, their spouse. Now, a comparative advantage can exist for basically one of two reasons. One reason is it may exist if the individual is better at some task, if they're more productive in the activity than any other member of the household. If that's the case, then we say they also have an absolute advantage. However, that's not a necessary condition for a comparative advantage. An individual could also have a comparative advantage simply because the cost of the individual's time and alternative activities is low. This may be because the individual has a relatively low value of time in the labor market because they face a relatively low wage rate, or an individual may have a comparative advantage even though they're not necessarily better in activity, but they're relatively less bad in that activity. Historically, we find that married women have disproportionately, at least, tended to specialize in household production, while married males have typically tended to specialize disproportionately in market production. There's several reasons that economists give for the specialization over time. In particular, it's generally argued that in past decades at least, this has occurred in large part because of high completed fertility rates in most households. The number of children that families had tended to be quite high historically. That through most of recorded history, infant mortality rates have been relatively high, and together, the fact that households chose to have a relatively large number of children and a relatively large number of children died before they reached the teenage years and so on, this resulted in a situation where females spent a relatively large portion of the time in a state of pregnancy or in a state of nursing and rearing of very young children. The third factor listed here is labor market discrimination, which reduced the value of women's time in the paid labor market. And basically, the argument that's normally suggested is that females had a comparative advantage in household production because it's easier to engage in household production while also being pregnant or rearing very young children. There's some complementarity between doing things like cooking meals and cleaning the house and so on and taking care of young children within the household. And secondly, since women tended to face relatively limited labor market opportunities and received relatively low wages in the labor market, the opportunity cost of their time in household activities was relatively low. This type of specialization tended to be encouraged by early childhood investments and training provided by the household. In particular, girls were generally given toys that encouraged or enhanced their productivity within the household, things such as dolls and tea sets and little cooking equipment and so on. And they generally tended to receive training from their mothers in general household production activities. Boys tended to receive toys such as construction sets, and so on, that tended to develop the types of skills that are more highly valued in markets, and in general, the types of training they received from their parents, typically their fathers, tended to emphasize things like all learning how to mow lawns, learning how to repair cars, to fix plumbing, to do wiring, and other types of production activities that in general tend to have a higher value in the paid labor market than in household production. Over time, though, as infant mortality rates have declined and completed fertility rates have declined, along with rising female wage rates in the markets, we might expect to see this division of labor between spouses being altered. In recent years, however, we see that married women have substantially increased the amount of time spent in the paid labor market and have spent slightly less time in household production. On the other hand, men are spending slightly less time in the market, but only slightly more time in household production. So the net effect, based on time allocation studies mostly done at Cornell, we see that women are working significantly more in total, while men are working about the same or perhaps slightly more. Women just now are working a much larger amount of time in the paid labor market, while the other adjustments have tended to be relatively minor. Now, in terms of whether the two spouses will work together in household production activities, those ZIs we talked about in the previous lecture, that's going to depend on whether the time of the two spouses is complementary or whether the time of each spouse serves as a substitute for the other spouse's time. In some tasks, we might expect that the time would be complementary, that if husband and wife, for example, enjoy doing activities together, then when one person spends more time in an activity, it raises the value of the other person's time in that. One might imagine, for example, that the benefits of spending time cooking and eating a meal might be enhanced by sharing that meal with someone that one cares about. On the other hand, in those tasks where there is little complementarity, one might expect to see a more complete specialization where you'll see one person or the other person doing a task, but not necessarily both of them doing it together. Earlier, we noted that labor force participation rates generally decline during recessions because of an increase in the number of discouraged workers. When we think about labor supply decisions in a household framework, though, the decision is not quite as simple as this, because if one spouse loses their job, becomes unemployed, one might expect that the other spouse might compensate for that by altering the mix of activities within the household, so that if one spouse becomes unemployed, the other spouse, who might be specializing to a great extent, for example, in household production, might decide to either enter the labor force or to spend a larger number of hours, at least, working in the paid labor market. To the extent to which this occurs, we have an additional worker effect that at least partly offsets the discouraged worker effect. So one thing that happens here is that even though when the unemployment rate goes up, some people will get discouraged and leave the labor force, spouses of some of the unemployed workers may decide to enter the labor force, resulting in a net expansion. The empirical evidence, though, suggests that the additional worker effect is much smaller in magnitude than the discouraged worker effect. What this means in practice is that when the unemployment rate goes up in the economy, when the economy enters a recession, we generally do see a net reduction in the size of the labor force, and the labor force participation rate goes down. One reason for the relatively small magnitude of the additional worker effect is that during a recession, expected wage rates fall, including the expected wage for the non-working individual or the spouse who is not the primary labor market participant. And the expected wage we can write as the expected value of the wage is equal to pi times w, where pi is the probability of employment and w is the wage rate if the individual is employed. As the unemployment rate goes up during a recession, the probability of being employed declines, leading to a reduction in the expected wage, as suggested by the equation on the screen. In one case, for example, you could receive $10 an hour with 100% probability, on average you'd be giving up $10 an hour by choosing to spend your time in non-market production. If, on the other hand, there's only a 50% probability of finding a job, on average you're only giving up $5 an hour by spending your time in alternative activities. So when the probability of being employed goes down, the opportunity cost of spending time in non-market activities is actually lower. In fact, in the very first or second day of the class, we talked a little bit about what happens to college enrollments during a recession, and we noted that one of the reasons why college enrollments tend to rise is because the probability of being employed, or the probability of being employed drops during a recession, lowering the opportunity cost of time, which is a major share of the cost of a college education. Another factor that we observe in terms of the allocation of time within households is that married women tend to increase their labor supply when a divorce within the household becomes more likely. One reason for this is that it serves to help prepare the married female for the reduction in the division of labor that occurs after the divorce. Since married females tend to spend less time in the paid labor market than married males, on average at least, after the divorce, we observe that per capita consumption declines by a larger amount in the portion of the split-off household headed by the divorced woman, by divorced women in general. And in consequence, we generally tend to see divorced women working more. And one way to help prepare for the later increase in labor supply is by acquiring more labor market experience prior to the actual dissolution of the marriage. Now, let's talk a little bit about how labor supply decisions change over time, over the course of the individual's work life. One thing that we do observe is that market productivity tends to rise over time, and this is reflected in changes in the wage rate, as shows in the diagram on the screen. That as an individual begins to work, their wage rate rises as a result of the acquisition of human capital through on-the-job training, formal training programs, and informal training programs that take place in the workplace or outside of the workplace, that individuals have more incentive to acquire more higher levels of human capital early in their lifetime because they receive those benefits, first of all, because the opportunity cost of time is relatively low early in their life cycle, and secondly, they receive benefits over a longer period. So investments in human capital cost less early in life and receive or generate higher levels of benefits when they're received earlier in life for the most part. So what we observe is that wages and productivity tend to go up fairly rapidly early in the individual's lifetime. Over time, however, the incentive to invest in further acquisition of skills and training tends to decline, both because the opportunity cost of that training becomes higher and also because the expected return on it or the expected benefit resulting from that as the remainder of the work life decreases becomes smaller. So the amount of human capital investment tends to decrease as the individual ages. In addition, beyond some point, the individual often becomes physically less productive due to deterioration in health status or reduction in physical strength and so on as the individual becomes older. And this accounts for the latter decline in real wage rates as the individual moves into the latter stages of the work life. In response to this life cycle pattern of wages, we see that individuals generally spend more time working in the paid labor market and less time in household production during the periods of their lifetime when market wage rates are relatively high. This should be reasonably intuitive. Suppose in a very simple case, you were paid different amounts at different times of a day, for example, that if you could get paid more between the hours of 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, you'd expect to allocate more time during these higher paying periods of the day. Well, the same set of principle occurs over the life cycle, that it makes more sense to spend a larger share of your time working during the periods of time when the return to work effort are greater, and to spend a smaller proportion of your time working during those periods of time when the return to paid market labor is lower. So we tend to observe individuals spending more and more hours of work as their wage rate increases, and to spend a smaller share of the time in paid market work during the earlier and latter stages of life when the return to paid market work is relatively low. A bit of an exception to this, though, historically at least, is that many married females have chosen to reduce the quantity of labor supplied or leave the labor force during their childbearing years. The diagram on the screen now can help explain this. That in making this decision concerning how much time to spend at work and how much to spend in non-market production, the individual is really comparing the benefits of working against the benefits of spending time in other activities, in household production. One thing that happens during the childbearing years is that the value of time spent in household production when children are present in the household become relatively high. That's reflected by the peak in the marginal product of time in household production during the mid-years of an individual's life, or the early to middle years of the individual's life. And what happens is that for individuals, for some individuals at least, the value of time spent in household production is greater than the value of time spent in the paid labor market. And during that period of time, you'd expect to see a reduction in labor supply or departure from the labor force. Over time, however, we see that happening for fewer individuals. And the main reasons for the reduction in for the change in this behavior is that in general, most married women choose to have fewer children. And when they have fewer children, the marginal product of time in household production tends to be lower, shifting that MP curve downward. In addition, the wage rate received by married women has increased for a variety of reasons, partly due to reductions in labor market discrimination, but also due to increase in female wage rates caused by increases in educational attainment and prior labor market experience and increases in productivity in general. So as the wage rate curve has shifted up and the marginal product of time and household production curve has shifted down, we see that it becomes optimal for a larger number of women, at least, not to leave the labor force during childbearing years. And today, most married females who have children less than a year old in the household choose not to leave the labor force, which is a very dramatic turnaround from the situation of 20 to 30 years ago. Now, let's talk about how changes in Social Security benefits will affect the choice of retirement age. The lower budget constraints in red on this diagram illustrates one level of Social Security benefits, or the budget constraints for one particular level of Social Security benefits. And this curve here tells you basically the trade-offs possible for retirement at different ages. If the individual retires at age 62, they receive the point in the vertex of that budget constraint. As they retire later at age of 63, 64, and so on in this diagram, the present value of the remaining lifetime income goes up. It doesn't rise quite as rapidly, however, as the increase in earnings, because they're giving up some Social Security benefits by working more, but they're gaining more pay from the paid labor market. And the budget constraints, or the budget constraint here, reflects that sort of trade-off. The curve on the top shows what would happen to the budget constraint if the level of Social Security benefits is increased. And one of the things we observe here is that as the level of Social Security benefits increase, we'd expect to see individuals retiring earlier. And historically, that's basically exactly what we've seen, that as the Social Security system was first introduced, we went from a system where it was very rare for individuals to retire at all to a system where individuals have, or at least males in general, have tended to retire at a progressively earlier age. One of the major reasons for this has been a gradual increase in the level of Social Security benefits over the course of the introduction, since the Social Security system has been introduced. It's likely we'll see a bit of a reversal of this trend as the level of Social Security benefits is gradually reduced somewhat due to the pending crisis in Social Security caused by changes in demographic factors, things such as a longer lifespan, and reduced fertility. In response to that, the government is reducing the level of benefits somewhat over the next 20 to 30 years or so to help maintain the solvency of Social Security. So you'd expect to see an increase in the age at which individuals retire as the benefits become reduced. On the other hand, we also see a system where private pension plans have increased in magnitude, and private pension plans also have a similar effect on labor supply, and as they become larger in magnitude, we'd still expect to see people retiring earlier. So what happens to retirement age is going to be an open question, because while Social Security benefits are likely to be reduced, private pension plans are likely to continue growing. Now, one of the things we noted in our earlier discussion is that a relatively large share of welfare payments are received by households headed by single parents, generally single mothers. As noted in the earlier discussion of the welfare system as it currently exists provides incentive for many such household heads to remain out of the labor force. This is illustrated by the diagram here. That the flat portion of the budget constraint is the portion received by an individual who's receiving a welfare benefit, and this individual receives the highest level of utility at the corner of the budget constraint corresponding to 0 hours of work, where basically all time is spent in household production activities and none is spent in the paid labor market. In recent years, or actually very recently, many states have begun to introduce child support assurance programs. These programs help to ensure that absent parents, generally fathers, contribute to the support of their children and introduce more incentives and enforcement mechanisms to induce such payments. This causes a budget constraint facing the custodial parent, generally the single mother, to shift vertically upward from the lower green line to the one vertically above that. In some cases, as this diagram suggests, the program will have no effect on labor supply, but will reduce total welfare expenditures. Because what happens here is that now the distance between the two budget constraints is the increase in payments from the absentee parent, and that reduces the total amount of payment the total amount of welfare payment going to the individual. If the if, for example, the target level of household income is $2,000 a month for this household, if the non-custodial parent pays $800 a month, the welfare benefit coming from the government is reduced from $2,000 down to $1,200, which would be the vertical distance between those two green budget constraints. So one effect of such a program would be to reduce total welfare expenditures at the state level, even if it has no effect on labor supply. In some cases, however, the program will encourage some single parents to leave welfare and enter the labor force, and that's illustrated in the diagram here, that originally this individual, when facing the lower budget constraint, found it optimal to receive a welfare payment at the corner of the budget constraint, as noted before. However, now that the budget constraint has shifted vertically upward due to the support payments received from the non-custodial parent, from the absentee parent here, the optimal point has shifted to the left here, and we see that this individual find it optimal to spend time working, and now the individual will not receive any welfare payments. So for these individuals, single parents, in particular, generally single mothers, would find it optimal to return to work or to enter the labor force and leave welfare in response to such a program. Other individuals who were working when the program was first introduced will have a pure income effect resulting from this, and the pure income effect would lead to a reduction in time at work and an increase in time in household production. Of course, this would have no effect on total welfare payments. So what we can conclude is that these child support assurance programs will reduce the total amount of welfare payments from the government, although they will require larger expenditures in ensuring that these support payments are actually made. The effect on the total amount of labor supply is not clear, because some individuals will not be affected, some individuals will choose to enter the labor force, but other individuals who are currently working and not receiving welfare will choose to work fewer hours.